Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In the next hour, we'll hear about upcoming plans for the future of Big Top Chautauqua and Mount Ashwell Bay in Bayfield. Plus, we speak with Twin Ports author Jerry Sandvik about his new book detailing the role Duluth and Superior shipyards played in supporting the Allies during World War II. But first, we turn to Big Top Chautauqua in Bayfield.
Howdy, folks. Live from Big Top Chautauqua, welcome to another episode of Tent Show Radio.
The nonprofit Performing Arts Theater announced plans last week to eventually give up doing shows under the big tent and build a permanent tent structure not far from its current location at the foot of a ski hill. We'll hear from representatives of both Big Top and Mount Ashwell Bay about their current relationship and changes that lie ahead for the two organizations. Up first, we hear from Big Top Executive Director Terry Mateer about their plans for the future.
The canvas circus tents that we use right now, they're not technically circus tents, but it looks like a big circus tent. They have a lifespan of about 6 years. We have to replace them every 6 years. So that model is not going to be working for us into the future for several reasons. One is that the availability of these tents, they're extremely hard to get. The company that we've always used, Anchor Industries, down in Evansville, Indiana, isn't making these anymore. No one's really making them anymore because they're not a very sustainable form of venue. So they've gone almost completely to vinyl. Vinyl is produced in a different way. They melt the fabrics together as opposed to sewing them. So all of the big equipment that they use to sew these massive tents isn't being kept operational any longer, and they don't have the manpower to use the machines anymore. So it's just not something, in addition to the cost, the way the cost has gone up over the years to make these big tents, it's just not sustainable into the future. So put that together with the fact that the weather has changed quite a bit up here, and these tents are not as waterproof as they used to be. So we've got wet seats, wet patrons, and some real liability with the winds. Everyone knows the big storms that we had last year. And, you know, at any time, the cloth building is really not sustainable for us at this level of operation. So we've recognized the fact that when this tent reaches the end of its life, which if all goes well will be 2019 would be our last season in this structure, the board has really been talking about what they want to replace this tent with. And I think it's in everyone's best interest to try to do something that's more sustainable for the long term of Big Top, which is more of a permanent structure instead of the canvas tent.
Okay, and so you're not looking at vinyl tents either?
No, we're not looking at vinyl tents. The other, you know, part of this is the process of putting the tent up in the spring, building the entire theater, and then taking it down in the fall and storing it all winter is something that we don't feel is the best way to be doing this into the future. So what we're looking at is some kind of a structure that can replicate the tent in all its charm and all of the best parts of the tent, but also help us with accessibility for our patrons and weather protection. We don't have a design structure yet. We're very much at the very beginning of this process, but what we're hoping is for some kind of a canopy that the tensile structures that withstand winds of 90 miles an hour and can withstand a wind snow load, so they can actually stay up all year long. And the seating then would be permanent, and that whole cycle of building a theater every spring and taking it down every fall would change. However, you know, we're really aware of the fact that we don't want the charm of the tent to change or the old-fashioned nature of the whole experience. That's going to be our challenge.
So, you know, that's, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was one of the questions I had when I saw that you're looking at building a permanent tent structure, if you were trying to make it look like the big tent still.
Yes, absolutely. One of the key things is going to be to find the right designer for the structure, because for me, it's all about the look of the tent, and it's all about the sound and the experience inside. And what we have right now is a beautiful thing, and we have to be very careful because it's our brand and it's what everybody loves about us. So we have to be very careful that we replicate that as best we can while we're solving these challenges that we have.
I mean, if you had to pinpoint it down to one main factor, is this tied to all the things that you've mentioned with the weather and the time and the manpower that's needed to set up and break down every year? Or is this also a financial in part?
Oh, it's both. You know, I think it's overall, it's the best decision for the sustainability of the Big Top. The level of artists that we're presenting now have requirements that, you know, we have to make sure that we can meet all of their needs when we bring them in. We're under contract with them to provide certain things. We're in danger of having to cancel a show because the tent is leaking and the stage is wet, and they're, you know, they have every right to refuse to perform, and we still pay their fee. They're there on site ready to perform, and we haven't kept up our end of the bargain. And with this current structure, there are times when that could happen, and that's, you know, not good for our liability and our sustainability. We have to solve that.
Okay. And so you said that Big Top is moving just down the road then, or would in the next few years. So where exactly would it be?
Well, we have been lucky enough to find a location through a longtime donor and supporter of the Big Top who has some land right there on Ski Hill Road. So the idea is that we're going to study this piece of property, which is about 70 acres, and it's very close to where we are right now. It's actually adjacent to the property that Ashwa Bay owns on Ski Hill Road. So we'll be studying that to see where could we build this structure and how would the whole thing lay out, and that's going to be this next three-year process.
Okay, because you're going to launch a strategic planning process come the summer.
Yes. The master planning process where someone comes in and studies all of your needs, all of your challenges, and the land available and matches it all up and helps you figure out what that's going to cost to implement all of these elements that you need.
So it sounds like you're bringing in an outside consultant. Have you pinpointed anyone yet?
No, we'll be putting out a request for proposals as soon as we have all of the details for that, and it'll be sent out far and wide, and whoever wants to apply for that role is welcome to apply. That'll be on our website when it's ready to go, probably early June.
So then, you, as far as the relationship then between Big Top Chautauqua and Mount Ashwa Bay,
yeah, yep.
How will that relationship change then? Are you still going to be working together, or are things going to look a little bit different?
Well, they might look a little bit different. We'll be a little bit more autonomous, as will they. But I expect that we'll still be doing projects together and working together, as we'll be neighbors. And I think we both support each other's organizations. You know, the Ski Hill has been a big part of my family life, and we want to make sure that they're healthy and survive and thrive, as well as the Big Top. But we've talked about doing recreation and arts festivals together, or doing events together, sharing services, sharing personnel. We don't really know what it will look like in the future, but we're both open to talking and having that evolve together.
So what's the current relationship between Mount Ashwa Bay Outdoor Education Foundation then and Big Top?
Well, the current relationship is that they own the property that Big Top puts up the tent on every year. So they basically are the landlords. They provide all the maintenance services. They, you know, do the grass. They do the gravel. They do different things. And then they also have the food and beverage service, the concessions, which is a fundraiser for their organization. They really can't do educational, recreational activities during the summer because of the Big Top being there. So that's been one of our negotiation points, is they wanted to do some more things in the summer. But we also, with this new facility, needed to own the land underneath whatever it was we were going to build. So it just worked out for both of our needs, I think, that we found another piece of land to build on. And that frees up the space for them to expand their educational operations in the summer.
Okay. And so I know change can be difficult for Well, I mean, I think it's difficult for just about anybody. But are you happy with the change that's taking place, or has this been kind of a difficult growing process for you or for Big Top?
Well, change is always hard, for sure. But I'm very excited for the future. I think this land that we're going to be at the same location, basically a little bit further down the hill, is just the perfect solution to what we've been trying to achieve. So I'm very excited to see what happens and look forward to, as these plans unroll, talk to people in the community, talk to our fans and our patrons and our donors, and find out what they'd like to see for our next 30 years. You know, we just celebrated our 30th anniversary, and we want to make sure that Big Top is still here 30 years from now and past that for the next generations. So I think it's our job right now and the job of the current board of directors to say, what are the right decisions to make now to make sure that that is ensured, that we're going to be here, we're going to be strong for this community for a long time.
And did I also hear that you're launching a fundraising campaign too?
We certainly will be launching a major capital campaign surrounding this project. So once this master plan is completed and we have preliminary budget figures on what it's going to take to build, then we're going to be doing a major campaign to find support for that to help us build it.
So what do you want Big Top fans or the community surrounding, you know, Ski Hill Road, what do you want them to know?
Well, I just like everybody to, you know, stay tuned, and we're always here in the office. If you have questions, I welcome people that have questions, concerns, comments, input to, you know, let me know what you're worried about or what you'd like to see or what you're excited about. And this is really going to be a project for our full community. And interestingly enough, you know, we have our longtime supporters here in Bayfield and Ashland and Washburn and this whole area that have been coming for years. We also have an expanded audience that comes from all over the state and really all over the country. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see the changes and to bring everybody in as part of it.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about your future plans for Big Top and what's next as far as the planning process that you're kicking off this summer. Thanks, Terry.
You're welcome, and I'd love to talk to you about it further as more plans are solidified.
Again, that was Big Top Executive Director Terry Mateer talking about changes that lie ahead for the Big Tent Show in Bayfield. Up next, we hear from Mount Ashwaubay General Manager Carol Ferencrew about how those changes may impact the ski hill.
I'm going to say just a brief piece of history. Mary Rice was very smart about how when she sold the ski hill to AOEF, Ashwaubay Outdoor Educational Foundation. She had a strong love for both the ski hill and also Big Top Chautauqua, which she helped found. So by what she did, she thought it would allow both businesses to flourish and succeed. The Ashwaubay was able to have all of the food and beverage that for the customers for Big Top Chautauqua, and in return for that, Big Top has exclusive rights to all of our properties starting in May all the way through October 1st, and for $1. So it was a very, you know, $1, pretty much anyone can afford that. And it allowed both businesses to flourish and be able to, it was just a really great partnership, so to speak. So what's happening right now is Ashwaubay, you know, didn't have any desire to break the lease, but Big Top does. Big Top has growing pains, and they have big dreams, and they want to have build a permanent structure, and they have, and quite honestly, I don't know what all their plans are because they really haven't shared them with us. And so we offered them land to just, they could just have the land. They don't have to, because that's the way the lease is. They don't have to buy anything. They don't have to give us money. Just tell us, let's agree on where you want to go. And because for us, it was very important that we retain that food and beverage business. And we exercised those options, all different ones, ever since I've been here, so for 3 years. All of us, it's not just myself, it's our boards that have spent time trying to figure out how to make it work.
Okay. So you said that you offered them land. What does that mean?
So we did a couple different things. One of them we said just, where do you want to go and build it? You don't have to own it. I mean, you have a lifetime lease. And they really want to own the land that they are on. They feel very strongly that they own land that they're on. And part of that is so they have control of, so they can take over control of the food and beverage. So they have the ability to generate revenue with that stream of income.
Okay. And so how much was Mount Ashwell Bay receiving from the food and beverage then?
We receive around $60,000. And that's after all the expenses have paid. And that money is our money that's what operates the ski hill. I mean, it's not, you know, ski hills don't make money. They whether they have to be owned by a big corporation like Vail or they are owned by a municipality like Duluth, the city of Duluth owns that and runs it. And so we're a very small nonprofit organization that we rely on that money to sustain the ski hill.
So now, you know, my understanding is that discussions between Big Top and Mount Ashwell Bay has broken down. Or how would you characterize it?
I wouldn't necessarily say broken down. I would say that, and both boards couldn't reach an agreement. I guess I can speak for Ashwell Bay. Ashwell Bay worked very hard on trying to listen to what they said they wanted and their needs. And one of the things that became very difficult was getting them a piece of land that didn't have ski trails already existing on them or the Kamba bike trails. You know, we were working hard to try to navigate around the infrastructure that's already here.
Now that Big Top has bought some land and has announced their intentions to eventually, several years from now, have a permanent tent structure, where does that leave Mount Ashwell Bay? What are you looking at? What are you considering?
One of the things that we need to do is, and you know, we've talked, this is all very new, so you're getting this where everybody's still a little raw from it. What we need to do is we need from Big Top, we have to have a final end date. Like it can't be, maybe in 3 years or maybe in 4 years, maybe in 5 years, because we have to be able to land on our feet. And in order to do that, we need an exit strategy from Big Top Chautauqua. So we need to know in 3 years they'll be gone. So we know that, you know, right now we start working on a business plan and start figuring out what we can do up here to generate revenue.
Because right now, the food and beverage, you said, supports the entire operation of the hill.
Right. I mean, that's a portion. All the proceeds to that goes 100% to the ski hill. I mean, we sell season passes and daily passes and those kind of things and, you know, ask for donations and support from the community. So with all of that is the piece, but it's a very large piece.
So what is it that Mount Ashwell Bay is considering then right now? I know you said you need a final end date, but what are you working on in the meantime?
Danielle, we literally just found out about this a week ago. So it's pretty new as far as knowing what our path ahead of us is. There's a lot of avenues out there that we have to explore, you know, whether we're going to, because the crucial part of bringing in a business up here, we have to have the market to do so. So, for instance, you know, we have to have, if we're looking at raising money in the summer, you know, we aren't on the lake, so it's not like we're going to, you know, take people out on a sailboat or take people out on a cruise ship. So what would bring people up to the hill that can generate that kind of money? And we don't have infrastructures in place right now for that. So if somebody says, oh, you can put a climbing wall up, well, that's an infrastructure that has to be built. So, for instance, I just found out for you, 57% of our income is food and beverage. So it's a pretty big piece of the pie.
Are you considering or have you ever considered doing summer events as part of
That was never an option for Ashwell Bay Outdoor Education Foundation because Big Top Chautauqua legally and lease binding wise had every single piece of our property for 4 months. It was never, ever an option to do any of those things up until 1 week ago.
And is that something that you want to explore things move forward?
We're going to have to, yes. Yes. I mean, of course. I mean, you know, with things like this, challenges are presented to you, but also great opportunities. So there is a great opportunity for us to figure out what else we can do for our community in the summer. But if you're going to ask, if you were to ask me, what would we choose? I personally, you know, our board president, it feels strongly that we feel that we were happy with the arrangement that we had.
So it's a difficult separation.
I think that there's, you know, it's given us quite a challenge and, like I said, a lot of opportunity for growth.
Well, what are your next steps, I guess, in the immediate future?
Well, step one, to make sure that that we have a clear exit strategy from Big Top Chautauqua, that we know that, you know, in 3 years that we will have complete control over our ski hill and not have any binding, anything that would bind us from being able to move forward.
Again, that was Mount Ashwa Bay General Manager Carol Ferencrew. Big Top's Terry Mateer says their intention is for Mount Ashwa Bay to have full use of the hill all year round once Big Top moves to its new location. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, Twin Ports author Jerry Sandvik talks about his new book detailing the role of Duluth and Superior shipyards in supporting the Allies during World War II. I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next, we hear from Jerry Sandvik. He's the author of World War II, Shipbuilding in Duluth and Superior.
America, traditionally a maritime nation, mobilizes its mechanical and its industrial genius to build the largest fleet of cargo ships ever to sail the seven seas. Average time to build a ship during the First World War, 11 months. Record time, 7.5 months. Now they're completing them in 46 days.
Before the U.S. entered World War II, it was already building ships to aid Britain in its fight against Germany. The U.S. was already building its merchant marine fleet. But President Franklin Delano Roosevelt authorized the Emergency Shipbuilding Program in 1941, and in the Twin Ports, about 200 ships were built in 5 to 8 shipyards, according to Mr. Sandvik here. And I just want to read this one passage from your introduction of the book where it says, "It has been said that when Hitler challenged the Royal Air Force, he asked for defeat. When he challenged the Russian army, he asked for disaster. But when he challenged the American economy, he was doomed." And thank you so much for being with us. I'm really looking forward to talking to you about your book.
Well, you're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
So what made you want to look into this topic?
Well, I'm a retired history professor. I spent my life in higher education as a history department chairman, as a dean of my college, and mostly teaching history. And I have always just had a passion for history and like researching, writing, talking about history, teaching. As a very young man, I got interested in the history of particularly World War I and World War II. And make a long story short, when I retired from the Twin Cities, several years ago I moved to Duluth because I just always have liked Lake Superior and being on the lake. And by the way, I was born and raised in Chippewa Falls, and so I have one foot in Wisconsin, even though I live in Minnesota. And so I've just always had this interest in World War II, and when I got to this area, I quickly realized that Duluth and Superior, I had a number of shipyards and made a major contribution to World War II, and that got me interested. And then I began volunteering at the Richard Bong Veterans Center, the Bong Museum here in Superior. And, of course, that's centered on World War II as well. So I guess on the bottom line, of a lifelong interest in history and that of World War II.
Well, and I love the way that you tell the stories of these ships, because you've got photos to illustrate everything, and that just puts you right back in the place and time of what life was like here in the Twin Ports back during the war. You know, and one of the things that struck me right away about reading about some of the history of shipbuilding here during the war effort was that a lot of them were wooden boats called subchasers, because in my mind I'm always thinking steel for ships, but they were called subchasers, and they were dubbed the Splinter Fleet. You know, how were these ships significant to the war during that period from 1940 to 1945?
Well, first of all, here comes my professorial business. I'll have to correct you, and you say a lot of them were wood. Only four of those were built in Duluth and Superior. Now, you're absolutely right that a large number were built during the war. Several cities in Lake Michigan built them, a shipyard in Milwaukee, one in Manitowoc. But in our area, there was just one small shipyard on Park Point. It was called Inland Waterways, and they received a Navy contract to build four of these subchasers. And there is a book written about it, not by me, by the way, but you're right. It's called The Splinter Fleet, and I suppose splinter because of the connection with wood. They were 110 feet long. They had a crew of about 25 men. I think it was two officers and 24 or 25 enlisted. They were small ships, but they were ocean capable. Indeed, they served in the Pacific and the Mediterranean. They were significant because in the early part of the war of the German submarines, the U-boat war in the Atlantic was probably the major threat to the Allies. And these small wooden subchasers carried enough armament to as the name says, chase the subs away. Because a submarine's whole tactic is stealth and hiding below the surface. On the surface, the submarine is very vulnerable. And so these wooden subchasers, such as were built here in the Twin Ports, had enough weapons to force a submarine to the surface and then a big enough gun to punch a hole in the pressure hull of a submarine. Once that was done, the submarine was terribly vulnerable. So they were an effective anti-submarine weapon. They were small, they were relatively cheap, easy to build. And up Minnesota's North Shore and on Wisconsin's South Shore, there were plenty of Norwegian and Swedish and Finnish guys that knew how to build wood boats, so they had some craftsmen that could do it here.
Well, yeah, and you also talked about how the workers that contributed to shipbuilding here in Duluth and Superior, how they really had no prior knowledge of welding or, you know, some of the skills that were needed to build these ships. But you said they learned pretty quick.
Well, I think it really speaks to probably the work ethic, the intelligence, and also the desire on the part of everybody of that generation to do their part for the war, that the men and women, I might add, were employed in shipyards. Many of the women that went to the shipyards had never worked outside the home before. It was that generation. I recently saw a poster that I liked very much. It said, women can't do hard, dirty, and dangerous work. And accompanied with it was a picture of a welding crew, all female, in one of the shipyards, wearing helmets and coveralls and everything. That's right. Many of the people, as I say, both men and women that worked on the ships had never done that before, but they could be trained as welders. They could be trained as pipe fitters, grinders, all sorts of these hard and dirty and sometimes dangerous jobs. But the people learned it and learned it quick. And they did modular construction, so a person did not have to be a jack of all trades. You were a welder, you were a pipe fitter, you were a grinder, specialized.
You worked on pieces of the whole.
Yes, you worked on pieces. That's absolutely right.
Okay. And, you know, originally this all began because President Roosevelt wanted the U.S. to assist Britain in the war effort. At that time, when this was all authorized, we hadn't yet entered the war. Pearl Harbor hadn't happened yet. So, I mean, do you have any idea how many ships that were built here in Duluth and Superior were actually used during the war as far as by the U.S. or by Britain?
You know, that's a good question, and I cannot give you a direct answer, but about 200 ships of all types. Some of these, a smaller number, were warships. I would say about 30 or 40 were combat vessels. Globe Shipyard here in Superior built some ocean-going tugs. and they were about 180 feet long, roughly. Most people don't think of, and indeed these tugs were not classified as warships or combat vessels, yet three of the tugs built in Superior actually participated in one of the most famous events of the war, which was the D-Day landings, June 6, 1944. A number of tugboats towed parts of big artificial harbors across the English Channel to put in place on the French coast that day, and I can document that at least three of the Superior Wisconsin-built tugs did that. One of them was fired on by German artillery, so a tugboat may not have been officially a combat vessel, but if the enemy's shooting at you, I think you are a combat vessel.
Yeah, you do what you have to do.
Exactly. But a number of the cargo ships were given to Great Britain. The pressing need really was, quite honestly, cargo ships. The U.S. and Canada could manufacture all of the food, the clothing, the ammunition that was needed, but unless it could be gotten to Great Britain and Europe, it was of no use. And so the cargo ships were, early in the war, really the critical bottleneck.
Yeah, and you talked about how the Great Lakes became crucial to that with the shipbuilding just because it took the pressure off of the coastal shipyards that were working on the warships as well.
It did. That was a major contribution. And understand, there were shipyards on Lake Erie, on Lake Michigan, as well as our shipyards here in the Twin Ports. And I think that certainly people will understand that the largest cargo ships, the famous Liberty ships, not to mention aircraft carriers, large cruisers and battleships, they could only be built on the coastal shipyards, Atlantic, Pacific, and Gulf. But to a real extent, the Great Lakes became America's fourth coast. And so by building some of the smaller vessels, cargo as well as combat, you're right, it took the pressure off the coastal yards so they could build the bigger ships and also repair combat-damaged vessels that could only be done there. So the Great Lakes ports did make, I think, a major contribution, despite some drawbacks geographically and climatically.
Right. And you talk about the difficulty they had with, you know, the close of the shipping season during the winter months and trying to get through all of that ice.
Yeah, well, clearly the winter months, you know, then as still today, impede the shipping or shipbuilding industry. But when it came to shipbuilding, the people in Walter Butler Shipyard, Globe Shipyard here in Superior, those men and women worked outside in snow and cold. I've got one wonderful picture that I've labeled shipyard work wasn't always shipbuilding. Big crew of men and a couple of trucks are just shoveling snow so they can get to their work, I guess.
And a lot bigger snowbanks, too, I might
yes, you're certainly right.
Than we see nowadays.
But. Yes, you certainly have a good point.
But you said that shipbuilding was 24 hours a day.
Yes, they worked three shifts.
Yeah, and so that there was never a quiet moment near the yard.
Rarely.
Yeah. Well, and one of the other things that you mentioned in your book was just how they tried to garner support for the war effort, and a lot of that involved, you know, the war bond drives, and Ingrid Bergman showed up in 1944 and came to Duluth as part of that drive and spoke before a bunch of workers at a shipyard in Duluth.
Well, yes, a ship launching was a formal and a real event. I mean, after all, these folks had worked on a ship for any number of weeks, months. And so it was a great climax to see the ship hit the water. And then also, as you've just suggested, in all American industries, including what we're talking about here, encouraging Americans to buy war bonds to finance the war was a large program. And so to have famous people like Ingrid Bergman that you just mentioned come and participate in the launching of the ship, or in Ms. Bergman's case, a war bond drive, was a big morale booster. People obviously turned out to see famous, you know, celebrities then, as we do still today. I might say, too, that there was an actress named Ann Baxter, who was an Oscar winner. She came here to launch one of the ships. By naval tradition, only females sponsor ships. And so they were very, the shipyards here in Duluth and Superior were very big on getting the wives of prominent politicians. You know, in those days, obviously, that was mostly men. But northern Wisconsin, in our district here in Superior, Alvin Okonski was a long, long time and very powerful member of the House of Representatives. Mrs. Okonski was invited to launch a ship. The wife of the governor, sometimes the wife of a city after whom a ship was named, would be invited. So prominent persons like that were very big.
And Dick Bong, too,
that's
speaking
right.
before workers at a shipyard. And you mentioned before about how it wasn't just men's work, that, you know, women had gotten involved in the war effort.
Oh, yes, certainly.
Welding, and sometimes there were all female crews. And you have this story about when Dick Bong comes to speak before a particular shipyard, and one of the female or one of the women welders comes up to him asking for his autograph.
Yes, and this lady I have not met, but I am told still lives in Two Harbors today and was a welder in the yard and met Dick Bong and got his photograph.
And then and photographs of him flying his P-38.
Yes, yes.
Over the shipyard.
Yes, I found one picture of Dick flying. And if you know airplanes, the P-38 had a very, very distinctive profile when you see it in the air. And he's flying a low pass over one of the shipyards, and there's a shed in the background, and you can clearly see the name. It says Walter Butler Shipyard. So it's one of those pieces of visual history that we can identify very, very precisely to the place and the time. So those kinds of historical finds are really wonderful. But I think this was a piece of history of Duluth and Superior that I got very interested in, and I think it's very important that it be preserved for future generations.
Well, what do you hope people take away from your book?
Well, I think a knowledge of World War II, of course, a knowledge, I hope, of the contribution of our local area. nobody can say one part of the United States won the war, but so many places, including our own, made, I think, a major contribution. I would hope, too, that people would understand that to win the war took a lot of cooperation, and it was really an all-out effort. There's one picture I used of Wendell Willkie. Most people don't know his name today, but he was the Republican candidate for president that lost to President Roosevelt in 1940. And yet, in 1942 and 43, I have a picture of Wendell Willkie visiting the shipyards here in Superior, lending his name to the war effort. So here's the defeated candidate for president. Rather than sitting home pouting or something, he's out doing his patriotic duty. And I'd like to think that spirit might continue in this country.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time to talk about it and all that you learned and sharing it with us. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, you were just listening to Twin Ports author Jerry Sandvik about his new book, World War II Shipbuilding in Duluth and Superior. Sandvik says all proceeds from sale of the book will go to benefit the Bong Historical Center in Superior. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but stick around. There's more to come. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next, we hear original works of fiction and poetry from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 7th Annual Writers Read event. The event is produced by Northland College in partnership with Wisconsin Public Radio and Aqueous Magazine. Each year, writers from the Twin Ports in northern Wisconsin write their best pieces surrounding a theme. This year's theme is the dark side. We just want to warn listeners that the content to follow may be disturbing for some. The following works were read earlier this year before a live audience at Northland College in Ashland. Here now are their poems and stories on the dark side.
My My name is Isabel Jacobson. I've got a little bit of a cold right now, so I apologize for that. I'm going to share a piece of creative nonfiction today about buying drugs when I was 18. I'd like to give a shout out to my mom if you're listening to the broadcast later. Forget what I just said, this is 100% fiction. Anyway, it's called How to Buy Adderall. Individual results may vary. In order to get what you want from Rico, you have to act like you don't want it. Approach him for unrelated reasons. Go to Olbrich Park with him just to hang out. Don't even bring it up at first. Rico has complicated feelings toward his amphetamines. He considers himself more intelligent than the party kids, delinquents, and deeply fucked up human beings that populate your social circle. Addiction to him is morally repugnant, and seeing so many of his friends behaving like addicts causes him great concern. He justifies his own Adderall use with the legitimacy of a doctor's prescription and maintains that he uses it in a healthy, constructive manner. It helps him concentrate on his schoolwork and so on. Yet he regularly stays up for several days at a time. He abuses his drugs as much or more than any of you, and he despises himself for it. So if you want him to give you pills, you have to venture as far into denial as Rico himself. You walk with him through the park. Mention casually how it's been a long time since you've done any Adderall, and wouldn't you know, you kind of miss it a little bit. When he wrings his hands over the other people who've been hitting him up, shake your head sadly and tell him how concerned you are for the rest of your friends. That's f***ed up, you say. Our group has gotten so dysfunctional. He likes talking about the group and how dysfunctional it is, because he likes to consider himself one step removed from it, a nonconformist, an individual. And so you represent yourself as a fellow nonconformist. Confide in him how lonely it is to be so much smarter than the rest of them. Listen as he says that he and mutual friend Michael are no longer speaking. Tell him in return the nasty things other members of the group have said about you behind your back. When he tells you about all the times Michael has shown up at his door asking, no, begging him for Adderall and about how bad that made him feel, you comfort him. Tell Rico he's a good person for no longer giving handouts to Michael, no longer helping him to harm himself. Then you laugh darkly, say, well, I was going to, you know, politely ask you for some Adderall tonight, but now I feel like that might maybe be a bad idea. Curl a smile up into the end of the sentence, slight head shake indicating your disappointment. Only slightly, though. Give the impression that you not getting some Adderall when you could have is an annoyance on the level of losing your pen somewhere or dropping a cookie on the ground. A little bit disappointing, but not by any means anything that is going to significantly ruin your night. He smiles wryly, doesn't give you a definitive yes or no. Change the subject. Reminisce about happier times before the group got quite so dysfunctional. Talk about college. Rico loves it when you talk about college. The fact that you're both leaving in the fall sets you apart from all the rest. While you've blundered with this subject in the past, making people think of you as stuck up, here you can play the college card to your advantage. They talk about you behind your back because they're jealous of you. And Rico, you're the only person who understands. Walk with him through the Olbrich Gardens parking lot, across the wide curbside strip of rain-wet grass, lush and fragrant in the cool summer dusk. Past this runs the bike path, and past that the long-abandoned Olbrich factory, the asphalt underfoot overgrown by prairie grasses, milkweed, thistle, and fragrant clover, bricked-in windows adorned with colorful spray paint. Point out a secluded spot behind an ivied, crumbling wall. He says it'd be a perfect spot to stop and smoke a bowl if only he had any weed. Offer that you happen to have a little bit, but when he distractedly shrugs and keeps walking in search of a better spot, you keep walking too. You don't want to seem too insistent with substances, even the ones Rico doesn't feel so guilty about enjoying. Let him see your nonchalance as proof of a healthy self-control. Talk about politics for a while. Talk about philosophy, talk about women. Climb the wall and sit there for a while, looking for constellations behind Madison's light pollution haze. And later, over at Rico's place, you follow him into the kitchen as he opens his prescription bottle and pours a pile of orange 20-milligram Adderall extended-release capsules into the container's white plastic lid. His hands are shaking a little. Feign interest in his collection of refrigerator magnets. Look everywhere except at the pills. When he asks how many you want, say two or three. Usually he'll give you two or three. This time, he hesitates for several long moments, staring down at the 10 or so pills in the pill bottle lid. Observe the tiny conflicted motions of his face and try to guess what he's thinking. Fighting an inner battle, perhaps, whether to give you nothing at all or to give away everything he has. He's done that before. Surrendered custody of the entire bottle to a girl he wanted to impress, trying to prove to her that he didn't need them. You wondered if he'd do it again. Your heart races. He gives you two, tips the rest back into the bottle. Try not to look disappointed. Pretend you couldn't see in his face his brief desire to rid himself of the drug entirely. And pretend you didn't see his immediate decision not to, the possessive cupping of his hand around the remaining capsules as he puts them away. You think momentarily of Lord of the Rings, tweaker body language of movie Gollum cradling the One Ring, eyes bulging as he whispers, "My precious!" Slide the two pills into your front pocket. Make small talk with Rico. Fix yourself a glass of lukewarm water from the tap and drink it, leaning on Rico's kitchen counter. You realize your other hand is playing with your pocket, moving the two little pills back and forth through tight thigh-hugging denim. It is reassuring to touch them. See again Gollum crouching spider-like in his cave, all angular knees and pale, long, bony fingers, lovingly stroking the precious, and deliberately place your hand palm down on the countertop. Finish your water. Drift toward the kitchen door. Rico asks, "What do you do when you're on Adderall?" He wants to quiet his own nagging doubts over giving you the pills. Wants to hear in your voice that you don't abuse them the way he does. You tell him. Sometimes I take them at parties. Mostly I just stay up all night and write. For the first time tonight, you're not sure you've given the right answer. To spend your sleepless amphetamine nights laying down great thickets of words onto a blank white screen, is it nobler somehow than the way your other friends are spending those same nights? Chattering and chain-smoking Newports outside somebody's house party. But Rico seems satisfied. Maybe to him it is nobler. Yourself, you're not quite sure. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Paul Peterson, and I drove over from Superior this evening. I'm going to read a couple poems tonight from a series I'm writing called Wind Shadows. This one's called Entanglement. She fries eggs, her back turned, dolloping avocado, sriracha, over corn tortilla, yellow as the pine-paneled walls all around, as the pine-paneled ceiling, as the pine-yellow doors, with black beans, wilted spinach, fresh tomato, in the kitchen of the cabin at Sobakin. Wind shadows are rare on Lake Superior. Waves crashing over rock shore up the tall glass windows, deck wet, slick ice. You can find them behind ore docks, beside a thousand footer, in the fading regards of another. Sunset, late fall, early winter, is a faint darkness. A sinking kind of sadness where your heart begins to evaporate at its borders. We walk in circles around the resort's dirt road, sequestered by hunting season. Past the lights of the drive, misty overhead, her tall relief elongates into a quietness of familiar conversation. She moves to the other room in the dead of the night. I awake alone and know it isn't temporal. And then this one's called Raindrops Fall Apart Together. Raindrops fall apart together, burning faintly like the wrong SIM card under a drone. or minivans on Xanax. Left turn signal, blinking. Blinking. Thank you.
Again, you are just listening to original works from writers across the region. Their work is part of the 7th annual Writers Read event, and that event is produced by Northland College in partnership with Wisconsin Public Radio and Aqueous Magazine. That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. And you can check us out on our Facebook page at facebook.com/KUWSFM. Check out a new series of programs called Not From Around Here. The series produced by UW Superior student Olivia Shalaby talks with 6 international students studying in Duluth and Superior. The students share their experiences abroad, cultural differences, stereotypes, and views about studying in the Twin Ports and the U.S. They also share their opinions on the current political climate towards foreigners. Not From Around Here, that's coming up this Monday evening at 7 for the next 4 Mondays here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.